microphones at the lectern, so if you would please move across to the nearest lectern so that we can get a clear recording of your questions, and the witness also has a microphone. One thing I'd ask you to note, and I haven't tested it in this room, but it's been my experience in rooms where we don't have a public address system set up, is that when counsel facing towards us are asking questions, sometimes their voices don't travel terribly well to the back. So when you are asking questions, please do lift your voice and try and project, and we will just check and make sure that people can hear at the back. Obviously, if the witness is just speaking directly towards the microphone, hopefully that will be able to be heard by everyone. Other than that, I don't think that there are any particular arrangements that I need to point out, but has anyone got any housekeeping matters or any question about the arrangements for this week that they want to raise?
Thank you, Sue. Just in relation to the direct attendance witnesses, some will be presenting their teams.
Yes.
I'm still a link will be seen.
Well, I think that's why we set up with the projector, so that the people will be visible. And if we're doing it via Teams, we can also have them on our screen and anyone else who links into Teams. That's our plan, isn't it, Ms. Kendall?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Anything else? Just a comment?
Your Honour, it might be in the category of housekeeping, but it was I've got a report back from Dr. Scarsbrook on the contaminant loading questions Commissioner Hodges had asked, and I can either read there's a three bullet point answer to that. I can read that into the transcript now, or I can have him prepare a supplementary an updated supplementary statement, so it's all in one place, if that would be preferable.
Yes, if it's only three bullet points, if you could provide that now and then in due course a supplementary statement, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. So the question from Commissioner Hodges was about whether the figures in Dr. Scarsbrook's supplementary evidence showing higher contaminant levels in the Waipa River than the Waikato River is because there are more contaminants going into the Waipa River, or because the Waikato River is larger, which dilutes the contaminants that are going into the Waikato River. Dr. Scarsbrook has advised that the Waipa River does have higher concentrations of contaminants than the Upper Waikato, and there are several reasons for this, including first the different geology. He advises that Waipa catchment has large areas of soft rock geology that is more prone to sediment generation via erosion. Second, the mitigating effects of the Waikato hydro lakes. Sediment and E. coli tend to either settle out or be killed off as they travel through the upper river's hydro lakes. And third, differences in nutrient uptake. Nutrient uptake by plants or algae is likely to be greater along the Waikato River due to increased retention times in hydro lakes and reasonable water clarity. In the Waipa, in contrast, particularly the lower reaches, the low water clarity is likely to constrain plant and algal growth, so nutrient uptake is reduced.
So that third one is really partly a consequence of the first two.
Yes, I think it's probably fair to say they're linked. But I'll have Dr. Scarsbrook, and perhaps by way of an updated supplementary statement rather than a proliferation of further ones, because it does tie into
It probably would be helpful if a paragraph or two along those lines could be added to that supplementary statement we have in one place.
Yes. And then the other matter that I'd been inquiring with Dr. Scarsbrook about was around the answers to a series of questions about setbacks and fencing lengths and stream lengths. His indication at this point, he's got the team working on it and liaising with other witnesses, but his indication at this point is it's probably around 2 to 3 weeks for provision of that information, but it may be that it's staggered. And what I'm intending to do is liaise with other councils that have expressed an interest in that issue and to see whether some sort of joint statement could be provided so that we're not providing something that other parties can say, well, actually it doesn't express our view of the possible range. So if we can provide one document that answers those questions as fully as we can,
yes,
in a way that shows the different views where that's relevant, we thought that might be of most assistance. So we'll continue working on that too.
Thank you. Anything else? No? Well, we'll continue with the evidence of Mr. Trebilco. There having been a weekend in between, I'll ask for the witness to be resworn. Thank you, Simon.
Would you like to swear up or not? Do you solemnly, sincerely, and truly declare and affirm that the evidence you are about to give this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Ferguson, I think you were the person we got to by the end of last week.
I think that's right.
You're set to go.
We have tables there.
Right. And are you okay going to one of the lecterns?
I'm not
going to.
The front one looks a little larger and has a shelf underneath, so given
yes,
the managing of documents, that might be easier.
There's also a small side table in front of it, and you're welcome to perhaps put that next to Ms. Tumai's position, or Mr. Conway's just lifting it around. So if you, because you've only got a couple of sheets of paper. And that is not at your expense at all, Mr. Ferguson. You are simply attempting to cope with what others have put in front of the court.
Precisely, sir. And I do only have a few sheets of paper, though, just unfortunately I've bound into quite large volumes.
Now, just speaking at that level, can I just ask the people at the back, can you hear Mr. Ferguson when he's speaking like that? Raise his voice a little.
About this volume or louder?
So I'm giving a thumbs up there. Thank you.
Mr. Trebilco, I've managed to hopefully refine the matters down over the course of the weekend. Given this is the last cross-examination you've got, subject to questions from the court, obviously. I just wanted to clarify a couple of matters in terms of your involvement and where I should start. As the King said to Alice, one should begin at the beginning, but I just need to make sure where your beginning is, given you've been at WRC since 1995, I understand. But when I was working through your time as a consents officer and then within the policy group for the first 8 and then another 7 years, and then a primary principal strategic advisor for 6 years, and then the last 6 years back in policy, but what I was trying to work out going through the documentation was when you first became directly involved in PC1 in terms of your evidence.
I was partially involved when the submissions came in on PC1, and I was helping with summarising and just checking some of the summarising of submissions that was done. So that was really when I came into it in any kind of meaningful way. And I've been fully involved since the appeals came in.
Right, so if we're looking at the process before the hearing committee and immediately prior to that, the Section 32 report, and I think there were 3 Section 42A reports prepared in the course of the hearing committee. Were you directly involved in any of those, or had some involvement?
Yes, I overlooked that. I did have a little bit of involvement with the Section 42A report, helping on the responses with respect to the overseer model.
But not on the 42. Sorry, that was the 42A or the 32?
42A.
42A, thank you. But in preparing for this appeal hearing, you obviously are now more fully familiar with the contents of, with that process and with the contents of those reports. Is that
yes,
fair?
Yes.
But in terms of the process for the development of PC1, going back to the collaborative group and the iwi co-management arrangements, are those matters that are better directed to Ms. May, in your view?
I would say so, yes. Thank you.
I just wanted to start with the plan change itself and just some comments you made last week. If you've got the version that's attached to the Regional Council's legal submissions, it's probably the safest starting point. Now, I think you took us, I think it might have been in your opening narrative, where you kind of stepped through key aspects of PC1 right at the beginning of your evidence before the court. And you emphasised objectives 1 and 2 and said that they were kind of directly interlinked with Tiriti Whaimana and giving effect to Tiriti Whaimana. That was right, wasn't it?
That's right.
But would you also accept that, in fact, when one looks at objective 3 and the relationship of Waipapa and Waipa communities for their social, economic, spiritual and cultural well-being, objective 4 in terms of tangata whenua values manifesting themselves through aspects of the policy, and objective 5 specifically in relation to health and well-being for whanga Māori or wetland, that those matters are also resonate strongly into Tiriti Whaimana, don't they?
Yes, I agree with that.
And I think a question was raised, forgive me, I can't recollect who did it, it may have been Commissioner Hodges, about why we haven't got an overarching objective, or at the very least an objective that directs attention to the fundamental purpose of PC1, which is to give effect to Tiriti Whaimana, or at least stage one of giving the journey to giving effect to. You recollect that?
Yes.
And I thought your answer, if I can recall, was it's implicit in PC1.
It is implicit, and I also don't know, I mean, I didn't write the objective, so I don't know if it was considered as an option for an objective. I also think that objectives 1 and 2, in the way that they're written, they interpret what it means to give effect to Te Tiriti Whaimana for the regional plan. So I think that's the reason why they kind of did it that way. Mm. I'd conjecture that as a reason.
Yes, yes. Because I think the tension point, and maybe it isn't a tension point, but it does mean that when one then has specific references to Te Tiriti Whaimana in some of the rules and methods, they kind of are quite stark and pointed, and and the question then arises as to whether they are the vehicles or the primary vehicles, or they're doing heavy lifting, as opposed to all the methods and rules and policies within the plan change. And if one did have an overarching policy or even something, a chapeau that said above these 5 objectives, that these are all for the purpose of giving effect to or beginning to give effect to Tiriti Whaimana, that would take the heat out of that a little bit more?
Possibly. And while I accept, as you said, that objectives 3, 4 and 5 are kind of inherent in Te Tiriti Whaimana, I think they're also quite important just from a general resource management point of view. I think they're important. So whether an overarching objective saying giving effect to Te Tiriti Whaimana necessarily covers off all of the resource management broader kind of part 2 things, I'm not so sure.
But you would accept, wouldn't you, that regardless of whether Te Tiriti Whaimana is expressed in a particular method or rule, that it must necessarily form a touchstone for the interpretation and application and implementation of those methods and rules at every level?
Yes, I agree in the sense that PC1 is aiming to give effect to Te Tiriti Whaimana. I'm saying that, I'm sort of hesitating in my answer, is that I think there was a very specific meaning for why Te Tūtai Whamana was specifically mentioned in Objective 4 and Policy 18. I think it was to kind of limit the restriction, not to broaden it in any way, if you like. So I read the intention of that mention differently.
And we might come back to that when we get to those policies, but your point there is we do need to be careful to make sure that if that was the intent, that this was to be a positive reflection, not a constricting reflection, the application of the Te Tūtai Whamana,
yes.
that is clearly coming through in the intent,
yes.
And the meaning. I was just looking for example. But you're obviously familiar with Variation 6.
Well, sort of. I wasn't involved in it again. And I think I was at the time a strategic manager.
Yeah. And I mean, that was obviously partway through at the time that Te Tūtai Whamana was reflected in the legislation in the form of the Waikato River Claims Settlement Act. But the mechanism used there, and perhaps, and this isn't a critical observation, but perhaps unsophisticated, but reflecting its time and the way in which Te Tūtai Whamana was trying to be kind of grappled with on the hoof, as it was in a plan change that was already partway through, was by including an objective of giving effect to the overarching purpose of the vision and strategy to restore and protect the health and wellbeing of the Waikato River for present and future generations. So in Variation 6, that was thought to be an important overarching objective. And then, and again, I don't think the drafting is ideal for reasons that should be very evident, that in some of the policies and rules there was then reference to doing things while having regard to giving effect to the requirement, which of course is a double legal weighting that struggles to make sense how you can have regard to giving effect to. But
yes.
The point there, I think, was trying to make sure that again, when grappling with consenting decisions, with grappling with
yes.
other matters, and here we were talking about water takes, was to make sure that people are constantly referring back to that touchstone of what we're trying to achieve.
But yes.
And that's equally as important here, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, yes, it definitely is. Te Tūtai Whamana is a very high-level document. It has a large range of objectives dealing with many things. And again, I think that's why the panel chose to interpret Te Tūtai Whamana in terms of what it was asking for in terms of water quality and the kinds of things that PC1 is seeking to manage. And again, I think that's why they didn't go for an overarching give effect to Te Tūtai Whamana, which is a very broad statement for a very broad vision and strategy, if you like, and could be difficult to implement or to know how to implement because of that. And I think that's why they tried to zero in and to restore and protect swimball, fishball, those sorts of things. And the objectives.
Look, and I think that's a fair comment about what this plan change is trying to do and trying not to do. And so it's very clearly, isn't it, acknowledging that there's an 80-year path
yes.
to achieving Te Tūtai Whamana, and we're grappling here with water quality and effects of land use through discharges and
yes.
and diffuse discharges. And so, therefore, there are other aspects of the regional plan that aren't part of this plan change that also resonate and impact upon the achievement of the Te Tūtai Whamana, and water take is
yes.
one of those, isn't it?
Yes.
And so, very much as the next plan, not only the plan, the next iteration of this plan change, but when you're looking at NPS FM 2020 and what has to be done in a very short frame of time, that speaks not only to discharges but also must speak to the impact of takes on water quality
yes.
as well. Accept that.
Yes.
If I could just take you to objective 4B in the first instance, and this is the tangata whenua values, which again is plenty of scope for looking at the wording, but the development of use and development of tangata whenua ancestral lands is in objective 4B, and this is a minor point, but I just wanted to clarify. The term tangata whenua ancestral lands is a defined term within the glossary, isn't it?
Yes.
And as a defined term, it includes lands returned through treaty settlements, doesn't
yes.
it? So we should probably, in objects, a statement such as objective 4B, simply be referring to tangata whenua ancestral lands as a defined term. We don't need that and land returned via treaty settlements stated.
That's very true.
Someone thinks it means something additional.
I don't think so.
No, I think it's just, it hasn't quite caught up with
one of those things I've read many times and never really spotted.
Now, when we go to that definition, and again, I don't think there's any change in that definition in terms of what's occurred post the hearings panel's decision, but it's on page 79 of the version attached to the regional council's legal submissions.
Yes.
So tangata whenua ancestral lands means land that has been returned through treaty settlement processes between the Crown and tangata whenua, or is, as at the date of notification, 22 October 2016, Māori freehold land under the jurisdiction of the Te Rere Whenua Māori Act 1993. Now, my friend, Mr. Majuri, I think, explored with you a couple of matters there. One was whether return through settlement process could be acquired under, I think, under settlement processes. And I think he was trying to capture the notion there that obviously, as part of the redress under many treaty settlements, it's not only land that's immediately returned, but there's often an ability to acquire further Crown land within a period of time, and so that's still part of the redress provided to the iwi under the settlement and therefore become settlement land in a sense. And that was what he was trying to get at. Now, with that understanding, is there any reason why you'd have concern about that potential expansion, which or alteration of wording, so that we're talking about land returned or acquired under treaty settlements?
I don't have a good understanding of these things, I'm afraid. Are you saying land, so if there's a sum of money, for example, as part of the settlement, and some of that money is used to buy land, is that one of the things you're thinking of?
No, I'm speaking, well, I can't speak for Mr. McGurry, obviously. Mm. But from my perspective, it would be where there is a specific right, often a right of first refusal, or an opportunity to purchase lands from a prescribed list that's in the schedule of Crown lands that are available and surplus. So where there's a mechanism that allows that, as opposed to we've received $50 million and we're just going to go and randomly buy land over the next 50 years. But ones where it's linked to a mechanism that allows land to be, specific parcels of land to be acquired in certain circumstances. You're more comfortable with that level of certainty?
Yeah, possibly, but again, I just don't think I have a clear enough understanding of the kind of legality of these things. I think the intention was for land that was returned through the settlement process, and perhaps there's an argument against what that actually is. Is it just the land returned, or as you say, an allowance for option for other land? I don't know. And of course, the second part of this is land that, not freehold land, which I understand is land that's always been in Māori ownership, part of that definition. So, I mean, there is a sort of quantum of land that was assumed was part of that, but certainly the intention was land return as part of freehold land, part of the settlement, and I'm assuming the intention was about land, Māori land, that was unable to be developed for one reason or another. I think that's what was trying to be recognised. Whether that definition does that well, I don't think I'm the right person to ask.
Yes, and I think, and perhaps getting into the definitional breakdown is not going to get us very far, given that fair limitation that you've given in terms of your answer. But what I was trying to deal with, given that at present at least, this manifests itself in a policy and in an objective that ultimately, in most cases, can only be realised through a non-compliant activity, land use change mechanism. So, I was just trying to get a feel from you as to whether this was an issue of principle as to what should be included, or whether there is a real sense of trying to constrain the amount of land that might be caught within this. And perhaps before you answer that, it just seems to me that if we're talking about a non-complying route, that's very difficult to get through, as I think we've already identified.
Yes.
The quantity of land that could potentially be the subject of an application actually a problem.
I think the principle is the most important part of that, rather than the land area limitation. That would be my assumption.
Can I just jump in here? Sorry, Mr. Ferguson. This is obviously a matter which I raised with you last week as well, Mr.
Yes.
Bell. Can I ask you to have a look at paragraph 45 of the rebuttal? Sorry, Mr. Ferguson, I know you have a special flag.
Not at all.
So, do you have that? Sorry,
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No rush.
Yes.
Paragraph 45, Mr. DeBelco, in your rebuttal.
Yes.
This is talking about this issue that Mr. Ferguson is raising, where this suggestion about general land being included in the definition of some of the female ancestral land. I see at the end of your... Well, firstly, you suggest that the amendment appears to be misplaced. And perhaps what occurred to me on this issue last week to suggest that it's not. But secondly, at the end of your paragraph, you talk about not supporting any changes to expand the definition beyond recognising land that has been disadvantaged due to historical appropriation. Now, what Mr. Ferguson is talking about is that not all lands are returned straight away via the treaty settlement process. There is what's known as a right of first refusal, which is often provided in settlement documents, which means Māori have the ability to acquire land after the settlement process and by way of purchase.
Yes.
So in that situation, it would have been land, because it's been made available not straight away in the settlement process, but by virtue of the settlement process, and has been made available because it was historically misappropriate, and often comes back in the form of general land, formerly crowned, but general land.
Yes.
In that situation, it must surely be a matter that should be included in the definition.
I think that sounds fair, yes. Within my limited understanding of these things, it does sound reasonable.
Thank you.
Can I just follow up on that? Do you know whether in the Section 42A reports or in the Section 32 analysis was any calculation or estimate or other measure, thank you, was any calculation or other measure undertaken of how much land this might involve?
I don't really know the answer to that. I haven't seen that.
No.
I've read most of those documents. I haven't seen a figure in relation to that. And again, Ms. May answer to that.
Because it does seem to me that if it's a marginal increment in the overall scheme of things,
yes,
we may be having a big argument
with
not much purpose.
I agree.
Or alternatively, it may be a real purpose, but it's a social and cultural purpose as
yes,
distinct from a water quality purpose.
Yes.
Right. I don't know if you have anything you can put in front of the witness and see if he knows that relates to these things of how much we're talking about.
I don't have the document in front of me, but I have a notion of 9,000 hectares cumulatively across the entire catchment, but I can double check that. I think 9,000 rings a bell.
That's not Māori owned land now, because I do have some numbers about that, but not to do with settlement.
I think that was Māori freehold land and settlement land.
Okay.
It might have just been Māori freehold land. I'll try and find it too soon. I wasn't able to get that data. I think it's an important point. Yes.
To see it in the overall scheme of things, and whether or not we're talking about something that, in terms of water quality or ultimate land use, is marginal, but in terms of social and cultural effects, could be quite significant.
That's right, sir.
Thank you.
What I will say, sir, is if I can ascertain additional information in relation to that, obviously.
Well, as with the other questions that we put forward last week, this sort of data in a plan change situation is actually quite important. Thank you.
Now, just continuing with the definition of Tangtapingi ancestral lands, and again, you may not be able to answer that, but it does seem that the date of notification, 22 October 2016, has been included as a kind of cut-off, and the sense I got from that was that for Māori freehold land, at the very least, it falls within the definition. And so I felt, reading that there was a sense that was intended to give some certainty to the quantum of land that was to be caught within that limb of the definition at the very least.
Yes, I would expect.
Whether that's a principled approach or not.
Yeah.
And therefore, land that acquired the status of Māori freehold land after 22 October 2016 on this definition isn't Tangata Whenua or ancestral land for this purpose.
That's true. It's difficult to, you know, if we're putting together a package of objectives and policies, to do that with something that's even more kind of unknown.
Plus, it would be fair, though, that is entirely dependent on what the status of that land then has in terms of the ability
yes,
to either change use or to apply for consents under
yes,
whatever the categories. That's the critical issue, isn't it, rather
yes,
than, again, the quantity. With the land that has been returned through settlement processes, doesn't have a date, but did you interpret that as has been returned at the date of notification? It's not expressly linked to that, or has been returned at any particular point in time while this plan change is operative?
Well, I think the date here is referring to Māori freehold land, as opposed to land returned. So yes, I think if we're talking about land returned through the settlement process, that could be before or after that date, I'm
sure. So there's obviously a capacity for that quantum.
That's right.
If the quantity was the focus of trying to constrict, then that's not constricted, is it? Because, for example, if Mr. Majuri's clients and the Iwi of Hauraki conclude some settlements, of which they're in the process of, and receive
yes,
land back within the catchment, then that amount of land increases, doesn't it?
That's right, and that comes back to the fact that it's the principle really that's important. I think that's right, but you know, we need to know what quantum of land we're talking about as well to understand the provisions, I think.
And it would be more important, wouldn't it, to grapple with those issues if we are looking at a different category, such as a discretionary activity or a restricted discretionary activity. And so one potential way of addressing that would be for the land figures that we have certainty around, as at the date of notification, for example, whether it's that freehold Māori land as at 2016, we can obviously quantify that. We can probably quantify settlement land. If that was under a restricted discretionary activity or discretionary activity status, as Mr. Majuri put to you, then potentially the broader extent of other land, whether that might be land owned by Māori, which, as Honour Judge Williams has said, is also under the jurisdiction of the Te Whiwhinga o Māori, those matters could be within the non-compliant activity status. In other words, you could differentiate between different classes, couldn't you?
Yes, you could. I couldn't say whether that's the right thing to do without knowing what the potential effect on the achievement of the objectives would be of doing that. And I don't know that at the moment.
We used to get a policy. Now this is a policy that again, and perhaps this is perhaps a little bit closer to a touchstone to kind of the objectives of the Te Tiri Whai Mana. When managing resource consent applications relating to the discharge of nitrogen phosphorus sediment and microbial pathogens, seek opportunities to advance achievement of the objectives in Te Tiri Whai Mana for the Waikato and Waipa rivers, including but not limited to opportunities to enhance biodiversity and functioning ecosystems and opportunities to enhance access and recreational values associated with the rivers. That's possibly getting close to a, albeit at a policy level, a kind of overarching touchstone, isn't it? At least within consent applications.
It's not quite how I would read that or interpret it. I think this is quite limited still to activities associated with managing the discharge of the four contaminants. So activities related to water quality. So from there, that's your starting point. Are there other things that could be achieved that relate to Te Tiri Whai Mana? But I think that's quite limited.
Right.
Rather than a general thing to do things to support Te Tiri Whai Mana. I see that as quite a limited policy.
So, in other words, when managing resource consent applications,
yes.
So you see that as a post-grant kind of issue? Or
not a post-grant, but it's something to be considered when determining conditions on a consent.
Right. So that's just like when considering and managing resource consent applications, to make that clearer that this is...
Yes, we could make that clearer, yes.
And when you're doing that, when considering and managing resource consent applications, I mean, you view this as being narrow, but seek opportunities to advance achievement of the objectives, then I suppose positively achieve, you know, looking at ways in which in consent conditions, including potential conditions relating to review, matters that achieve the objectives in Te Tiri Whai Mana would be useful touchstones, wouldn't they?
Possibly, but I don't think that's what that policy is talking about. I think it is quite constrained. To me, it is about those things that a farmer is doing on their land, and while you're protecting water quality, can you do some other things on the land as that farmer? Because because of the broader range of objectives of Te Tiriti. So I think it's still quite constrained to the things that farmers are doing on their land, and that can be controlled by consent conditions.
Just in terms of review mechanisms, in terms of the controlled activity rule 311, 4.5 and 4.4, both of those include among matters upon which the Waipapa Regional Council reserves control at Roman 9 in the amended version, the time frame and circumstances under which resource consent conditions may be reviewed.
Yes.
And I think that's also in the restricted discretionary activity rule 311.4.7a has also got a similar restriction of discretion to Roman 10, the time frame and circumstances under which consent conditions may be reviewed. And I just wanted to touch on the issue of review conditions and whether there needs to be a greater point, or should reasonably be a greater point of direction within all consents where conditions are to be imposed, about matters that may be the subject of review by the council in terms of section 128, linking back again to this fundamental goal we've got of achieving on a step change basis to Te Tiriti. Do you think there might be some merit in some greater policy direction around that, as opposed to these specific references which don't link especially to Te Tiriti?
Possibly, yes. We'd have to see what the wording is, and I must admit it's been a while since I've written the review clause, and you know, I know that there are restrictions on them. They're not easy things to use legally and so on. So I'm not sure that if you're suggesting that if we find that we're not on the trajectory that we want to be in terms of meeting the target entry of states, whether that would be a cause for review. I don't really know how difficult that might be, depends on the words that you're talking about.
Well, if it was a discretion for the council to review on those circumstances, wording there shouldn't be too challenging, would it?
I'm not sure. I'm sorry, it's been a while since I've looked at the restrictions on the review clauses and the difficulties of using them.
No, I appreciate that. But what we have got is quite a criticality, don't we, in terms of we've got set target attribute states.
Yes.
At a sub-catchment level.
Yes.
We've got clear targets to be achieved, the 20% targets within the first 10 years.
Yes.
And we've got a range of mechanisms through a combination of committed activities.
Yes.
And controlled activities and restricted discretionary activities and discretionary activities, which to a greater or less extent are highly dependent on, or put a lot of faith into farm plans, one thing, don't they?
Yes.
And if we actually have that data coming in on a subcatchment basis and on a farm unit basis, subject to some of the challenges I think you indicated about the science for the connectivity, we can see, can't we, whether a subcatchment is tracking, if we call it that, and if it's not tracking, then, well, we've got the activities within that subcatchment and potentially further upstream subcatchments. That are the potential causes of that. That would be fair?
Well, that's fair. Tracking how the subcatchment targets are going, or how we're going in terms of the targets, it's not something we can, I mean, it takes time. We won't know for 5 years, I don't think, how things are going once things start to change on the land. And I do think we don't have any good way of linking what's happening on a farm to what's happening at the subcatchment level. So I still think it would be very difficult to say for this farm's consent they are responsible for not meeting these targets in some way that would mean you should review its conditions. So I think that would be a difficult thing to do at that level.
And presumably one could review all the farms within the subcatchment as another alternative.
Yes,
approach.
I mean, you could, yes. Absolutely.
You mentioned the five-year date, and it reminded me, when considering the water take applications for WaterCare, that there were a series of, I think, five-yearly review dates from which, and I think they were linked to subcatchments, as I recollect.
Yes.
Is there something similar that we can put hook into, as, again, reviews are still may, not must, but are there regular five-yearly intervals that would have some utility, given that, I think, as was put somewhat agriculturally, I think it was Mr. McGurry's term, we are a bit of suck and see in this.
Yes. I keep the thing I've had most experience with is the monitoring for Lake Taupo against the Taupo provisions, and it's been a very, very interesting thing to watch, because over the first 15-20 years the nitrogen monitoring was going up and you'd think we're not achieving anything here, and then suddenly it's dropped down like that, and it's been stable over the last 2 or 3 years. If I ask Mr. Bill Vant, who was the chief scientist at the time, at any point along there, and I asked him many times, how are we doing? Does it look good? Does it look bad? And he says, well, don't know yet. Might just turn around and start doing something different in terms of the trends. And I think this is the problem with science around the targets. They're an indication over 5 years, 10 years, we'll get a better indication. Don't know if 5 years necessarily will give a scientist a strong enough kind of view, and you would know scientists as well as I do, they don't like committing to the meaning of their statistics. So it's a difficult thing. You may be right, it's a difficult thing.
Well, at the very least, we're going to need some figures in 10 years, aren't we?
Yes, well, absolutely, and I think we need to keep looking at the figures. It's when do you make conclusions about it in terms of how we're doing, and what kind of conclusions are they, and how specific are they to their properties and so on?
Well, the critical thing is to be able, I suppose, even if we're looking in 10 years' time, is to be able to not throw our hands in the air and go, we haven't hit the targets, and we don't know why or where, but actually to be able to have some quite nuanced and bespoke and targeted actions and responses in terms of the next iteration of the plan change.
Yes, absolutely.
I wanted to take you back to Rule 311.49 in terms of the non-complying activity rule for land use change. And in doing this, I wanted to refer to two other documents. So one is the Section 32 report, which is in the 501 volume, at tab 16.
Is that part 1 or 2?
I'm not sure I've got a part 1 or 2, so it's tab 16. It's the best I can achieve. Probably tab 1.
It is part 1.
And the other document I wanted to refer you to at the same time, in this series of questions, is the plan change as notified, which is in volume 101, tab 1. And I think just going back to last week and an answer to some questions, I think from Mr. Majuri, it may have been from somebody else earlier, that you said that in your understanding this wasn't intended to be a moratorium, Rule 311.49, that's correct.
Yes.
And, but you also were fairly firm in your view that it wasn't intended to be an interim rule either. And
that's right, as it's turned out through the decision process. I don't think it's intended to be an interim rule. I think it was intended to take us to the next plan change.
Right. Which is what the whether it was the sunset date or whatever one called it, or 2026, was intending to do, wasn't it, in terms of that was 10 years after notification.
Yes, that's right.
So that's the frame we were looking at in terms of this rule.
Yes.
And so whether you view that as interim for that period or whether there was some greater quality or principle behind that interim status...
Yes.
That was what I was just wanting to,
yes,
to test with you. Because when I go to, for example, and actually, sorry, you've got volume 1 of 501, haven't you?
Yes.
Does that start at 15, or does it start, I referred you to document 16, which was the Section 32 report. Is there a document before that, tab 15?
Document called Restoring and Protecting Our Water. That tab 15.
Yes, tab 15. Sorry, so perhaps if I take to that tab first. Now this document here, it starts on 501.1.2.0.2, Restoring and Protecting Our Water. Overview of collaborative stakeholder groups' recommendations for Waikato Regional Plan Change Number 1.
Sorry, could you just cite the page again?
Oh, sorry. I think it is... Well, I'm just looking at the cover sheet, which is 1282. That's the page you've got in front of you.
Right.
I'm just looking at the cover page.
Oh, yes, yes.
Sorry, the number's probably invisible because it's in
yes.
black.
Yes.
So this is an overview of the recommendations that came from the collaborative stakeholder group that was set up as part of the process towards developing Plan Change 1, wasn't it?
I don't know, sir. I wasn't involved in that process. I don't
you're aware there was a collaborative stakeholder group?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And this is overview of collaborative stakeholder group's recommendations. You've set
That's
that?
True, yes.
Yes. And you'll see on the document at the bottom, Healthy Rivers Plan, Waiora Plan for Change, Hirotaki Whakapaepae, and these series of documents relating to the process pre-council, the recommendation going to council, was that many of these documents have got the five river iwi and the regional council notified on them, reflecting that collaborative co-management process, doesn't it?
Yes.
That's right. Okay, so if this is the overview of the recommendations that came out of the stakeholder group, I wondered if I could... take you first to page 501.1329, which is page 44 of the document itself.
Yes.
And now I just wanted to just note at the top of that page, I said 5.2, policy on preparing for allocation decision in the next plan change.
Yes.
The policy intent is to set out what will be considered in the next plan change where individual rights to discharge contaminants in the form of a property level limit will be allocated and new rules put in place. The policy will be based on the CSG's principles for future allocation, which we dealt with in the earlier one. There's quite a clear flavour coming through from this that the next plan change is going to take another significant step forward.
Yes.
And that's correct?
That was certainly the intention at the time.
Yes.
Yes.
And certainly... And we might come back to this, the CSG was looking at a range of alternative options for grappling with the issue of allocation and related matters, as you know, and felt it was a bit too soon to try and do these in the first plan change, and that they instead, but that we needed some clear messaging of intent going forward. Recollect that was the flavour of...
That's right, but I don't think it was a matter of being too soon. It was just that they didn't have a tool that they thought
right.
they could use to allocate with.
Appreciate that. And then you'll see on the next page there, 5.7, policy on flexibility for development of land returned under the Treaty of Waitangi Settlements and multiple owned Māori land. And it's again a policy point there. Perhaps if I could then take you on a few pages to 501.1333, which is page 48 of the CSG report.
Yes.
And you'll see 16.2 interim, in brackets, land use change.
Yes.
The aim of this approach to managing discharges is to call a temporary halt to large land use changes that occur in the catchment, therefore associated increases in discharges. Go on to the next page, this paragraph beginning, this approach. This approach is described as interim, and the intent is that this non-complying rule would be removed from the Waikato Regional Plan and replaced when future plan changes set property level numerical limits and discharge allocations.
Yes.
The 2016 plan change can include policy direction that this rule is to be reviewed when the allocation of property limits are written into the plan and made operative. The CSG considered that this rule would be clearer than a rule based on any general trend in intensification. The approach in place from plan allocation does not require benchmarking through overseer. The focus is to capture major land use change while the other policy approaches are being rolled out. The rule will have strong policy direction associated with it to guide when it would be appropriate consent granted. Now, obviously, it all changes a little bit, but the intent of the CSG was quite clear in that regard, wasn't it? This is a limited interim measure that needed to be supported by strong policy direction, and the anticipation was the next plan change would be grappling much more substantively with the way in which we're going to address these matters. That's fair.
Yes.
And I feel somehow that what some of us have been struggling before the court with is kind of a bit of absence about what that policy direction now is in terms of this. This flavour seems to have been lost somewhat through the hearing committee decisions version. Would you agree that?
Yes, I do agree that the flavour has kind of been lost to a point in the sense. I think it's still there in policy 10-ish. Says prepare for further diffuse discharge reductions and any future management regime, in brackets, including potentially the allocation of diffuse discharges of contaminants. So the idea is still there, and I think the intention is still there that we do develop an allocation regime, and then that may change things in terms of development of tangawhenua ancestral land. You may have a tool that you could use or a technique you could use to allocate. I think the intention is still to think about that and try and go there, but of course we can't anticipate or limit what might happen in the future plan change. So that's as far as.
So we've got this slight flag to the potential.
Yes.
For allocation.
Yes. Yes, it's not strong.
No.
I agree.
But you'd agree. Perhaps if I take you to another document just to reconfirm. We were in this regard. I think you've got the section 32 report there, tab 16, the next tab.
Yes.
I said I would take you to, so I should keep with my word. You'll see in that, if you go to page 501.1549.
Just taking a bit of time to find it again.
Sorry?
Yes, I've got it now.
501.1549, which is page 184 of the section 32 report.
Yes.
And you see on page 1549, that's heading E4, restricting land use changes.
Yes.
And at that stage, you'll see the policy 6, restricting land use change. And Rule 311.5.7, which is the non-complying activity rule, which were the subject of focus at this stage, and obviously they've changed a little bit as to the numbering and other matters. Now, if you just, on the second page there, 1550, again, this is the council evaluation, so again reflecting what the council's clear understanding was. So general comments, controls on land use change are designed to be interim with the intent that they be removed from the regional plan and future plan changes. Referral to the discussion and staging the transition to the AU guide. Putting controls on changing land uses impacts future opportunities. It was identified that certain types of Māori freehold land under the Waimana Māori Act 1993 and treaty settlement land have historical and contemporary legal impediments that have affected the use of the land. Provisions controlling land use change have the potential to negatively impact upon the relationship of Māori with their ancestral land. Therefore, an additional set of provisions was investigated to deal with the consequences of the land use change provisions, refer to certain flexibility use, and that's the policy 18 equivalent being developed. So you'll see that there, again, focusing on this, the principle behind the measure and its interim nature, that's correct?
Yes.
And then go through looking at a couple of options there. You just rely on the existing plan or imposing rule controls on rules. And if we go on a few more pages, you'll see E4.5 on the next page, effectiveness of option 2, controls on lands, and then the report addresses relevance, feasibility. And then on page 1553, we have a heading acceptability. And about halfway down, you'll see a key factor paragraph.
Yes.
A key factor in the acceptability of this policy and rule is its interim nature, which foresees that these provisions will be replaced by future plan changes. It was judged to be unacceptable to lock in current land changes indefinitely without the specified time frame. Therefore, an important part of the non-compliant activity rule for the land change use is the end date of 2026. If the land use rule no longer has effect from the date specified in the rule, then the change of land use will no longer require resource consent. Specifying an end date means that the adverse effects of any land use change after that date are only covered by the remaining rules. The intent is to commit the Waikato Regional Council to establishing new rules, and then it goes on, consultation with the community. Had a question, should there be an interim catchment rule limit, and while the plan change has been implemented in 74-26, there's no response. So again, quite clear about not only purpose and principle, but also the expectation on the Regional Council. The intent is to commit the Regional Council to establishing new rules in the next plan change. That's correct?
Yes.
Now, do you think that's somehow been got lost by the hearing committee in its decision, or have we got a rule now that's trying to do something different, or do you think these principles still sit behind the rule, even if they're not explicit, given we've got the removal of the 2026 date?
Well, I think it was intentional to remove the 2026 date out of the rule. I mean, that was their decision made on based on some of the submissions, I understand.
I'm interested in it. You say, well, some of the submissions, I haven't been able to find a submission asking for the date to be removed. And I don't think they say these submissions.
No, they don't. I have found their submission, but it wasn't in the original submission batch. I think it might have been to the after the change to deal with the Hauraki iwi issue. There was a submission that referred to the end date. I'd have to find it again. It was a couple of years since I've seen that, but I was also looking for the submission that gave the ability to do that.
Yes, I was somewhat troubled by that myself.
Yes, it's not in that initial set of submissions, but there was one that I did find, which I could find again for you. The main reason, though, I think, that they chose to delete the end date was just because the process was taking so long, and they could see that the 2026 date was going to come up well shorter than the 10-year term when the plan change actually becomes operative. Yes. So that was the key problem I think they were trying to identify. I don't know the whole reasoning for why they didn't put a later date or some other way of doing things. I think there is some explanation, probably very briefly, in the decision report, but I can't quote that.
And look, one can appreciate that issue about 2026 rapidly advancing, and there has been talk of, and I think a proposal by some parties at the very least, that rule should be linked still to within 10 years of the plan becoming operative.
Yes.
Because that, at the very least, wouldn't you agree, then reflects this notion that this was very definitely interim and that there was an expectation that we were going to have to do something quite different the next plan change. And when you remove that kind of end date, to somebody coming fresh to this, that whole context is missing, isn't it? And it just looks like,
I agree. But I think there is a real risk to the plan if we put another 10-year date in there, because we all know that 10 years come and go, and then there's a process which is maybe another 10 years or could be 5 years to put new rules in place. I don't think it's acceptable to end up in a situation where potentially significant land use consent applications would need to be processed under a probably an anonymous situation, discretionary under the Act, when the test is suddenly changed. So it's not about a test where an application needs to be considered as to whether it's contrary or not to the objectives and policies. It's a test of have regard to, and that test, my understanding of it, not being a lawyer, but I will read the understanding I have, is that have regard to means give those matters genuine attention and thought, but the decision maker is not necessarily required to accept them. So if we have applications processed under that kind of a regime, which to me is quite unrestrictive in a way in terms of what a consent officer needs to look at, that's not consistent with giving effect to tutti frumenti, in my view. So that's why I don't like the idea of a 10-year rule, and then it stops, and then these activities, which could have significant effects on the ability to achieve objectives, are merely discretionary activities.
Two matters. One, taking the approach that you've said also locks all Tangata Whenua ancestral land development into that frame, doesn't it? With this uncertainty as to when you might have some.
Yes, I agree.
And so while I understand the concern generically in terms of land use change within the catchment, one solution to that is to actually have a bespoke rule that relates to Tangata Whenua ancestral land specifically.
That
potentially, as Mr. McCurry has advocated, moves that into a restricted discretionary activity status with the appropriate conditions there.
Yes.
That would take the heat out of that in terms of the ongoing entrenchment of an obstacle to development.
That's right, it may do, but I haven't seen an analysis of what potential adverse effects or any Section 32 type analysis of a discretionary or restricted discretionary activity. So I don't know what the potential impacts of that could be on the appropriateness of achieving the objectives. That's my problem with that.
Yeah.
In principle, I could say, yes, possibly, but I would need a whole lot more information to know if that's a really good idea or not in terms of Section 32.
Well, perhaps if I could take you to the Section 32 report that we're looking at just before, which is tab 16 of the 501, which I think is in volume 1, if there were 2 volumes.
Yes.
And if I could take you to page 1573. And you'll see this is there was a cross-reference to this earlier when we were looking at the restricted land use of E4, where there's a cross-reference to an additional set of provisions were investigated to deal with the consequences of land use changes, and it said refer to E7, flexibility of the use of tangata whenua and sediment land. And so this is E7, flexibility of the use of the tiwi whenua and settlement land.
Yes.
And this section evaluates the appropriateness of the provision of plan change to achieve the objectives with regard to providing for the flexibility of land returned under settlement processes in Māori freehold land from jurisdiction of the Tiwi Whenua Māori Act. And you'll see here's reference to policy 16 and objective 5 in this regard, which are numbers have changed, but those are those touchstones that are still in the plan, will be in slightly different words.
Yes.
And then you'll see what this section, 35 report, does is identifies 7 options to achieve long-term and short-term numerical and narrative threshold objectives while providing for flexibility of use of and settlement land. So one's rely on the provision for managing land use change. Secondly, develop new policy. Third, develop new rule policies and rules. Third, exempt Tiwi Whenua and settlement land from land use change. 5, cap and trade. 6, cap and trade within Māori freehold land and settlement land. And finally, 7, offsets. So all of those options were identified. You see that?
Yes.
And then in E7.3 on page 1574, those options are each described in a little bit of detail at the very least. But you'll see option 2 is develop a new policy, policy 16 and non-complying activity rule. And then option 3, develop a specific policy and rule for most freehold land and settlement land, policy 16 and a discretionary activity rule. And notes under option 3 there, one variation of this option is to include a schedule to be developed that would identify parcels of land that could utilise any alternative framework, and then a second variation was to cap the total hectareage of land able to use to change use under any alternative rule framework. You see that option?
Yes.
So that option, which is the one you said before that you weren't aware had been considered within a Section 32 context, at the very least it's mentioned in the Section 32 report. You'd accept that?
Yes.
And then when we move on to the next page, it's E7.4, evaluation of options. And you'll see under option 2, about halfway down that page, 1.75 the page, the last paragraph, this option is considered the most appropriate way to achieve objective 5. So that's the non-compliant activity rule. You'll see that statement.
Yes.
And then you get to option 3, which is the discretionary activity approach, slightly longer discussion, and then it says this option is not considered the most appropriate way to achieve objective 5, and that's also a statement that's made under the other in relation to the other 6 options. So there's clearly highlighted option 2 here, and then if we turn over the page again to 1577, you'll see kind of a summary right about halfway down and starting in bold. You'll see options 1, 4, 5, 6 and 7 are not feasible or do not achieve the objectives of Plan Change 1 and so have not been progressed. Options 2 and 3 offer components that are feasible and so were investigated further. Legal advice, technical information and riverine input were used when determining which components of the options should be combined to form the desired policy approach. Having regard to this information, is the Council's view that policies, rules and other methods to implement option 2, when you develop a new policy, that's a non-compliant rule policy, is the most appropriate way to achieve the objective of Plan Change 1. That's correct?
Yes.
And so then, what we've got is the more orthodox Section 32 assessment of effectiveness of option 2, so in terms of relevance, feasibility, acceptability, CSG's policy criteria, and then over those two pages, and if you turn over the next page to 1579, you'll see efficiency being addressed of option 2 again, in terms of environmental, economic, social, etc. So we've got And that goes on right through into a summary on page 1582, summary of efficiency. The economic, social, and cultural benefits would contribute to achieving the objectives of Plan Change 1. Now, interestingly, even though this is an option 2, develop a new policy, it then says the breaches of the 10-year targets of Plan Change 1 are only slightly exacerbated by development of Māori freehold land under the Te Whenua Māori Act and settlement land. So these breaches occur at a small number of sites. Overall, the breaches of the 10-year targets and total nitrogen nitrate are predicted to not have a perceptible impact on chlorophyll A levels. This highlights that the material implication of these breaches for ecosystem health of waters within the catchment is rather benign. Now, what it's looking at there is assuming that you did develop through and grant all the land use consents through a non-complying, this is their assessment of actually the impacts of that, isn't it?
Yes. I think they're talking broadly across the whole BC1 area.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. So if there was development of Māori freehold land and settlement land through an even a non-complying activity rule, again, not predicted to have a perceptible impact on chlorophyll and in material implications of breaches for ecosystem health, rather benign. But that's done in the context of a Section 32 analysis of Option 2, the non-compliant activity. There isn't actually a full Section 32 analysis of Option 3, is there?
No.
The discretionary activity rule?
Yes.
No. But there's a sense there that they've appreciated that whether it's done through a non-compliant activity or even if it was done through a discretionary activity, again, the impacts are in that level. That's what's been identified in the Section 32 report, isn't it?
I don't see it as saying that, no.
Well, it says if you did the land change, use change of all the Māori land and settlement land,
yes,
those are the effects. So whether that change is done through a land use change or through a discretionary rule, that doesn't affect.
Yes, I guess so, but I have to say that it is just talking about an option of a non-compliant rule process.
But it assumes development of that land, doesn't it? It assumes land use change.
Yes, I think that's true.
That's right. And obviously those discretionary rules, if there was to be a discretionary or restricted discretionary rule for tangata whenua ranches for land development, then that too necessitates a land use change, doesn't it? Combined with some other activity consent, doesn't it?
Yes.
Now just interlinked with that point, at this stage when we were dealing with this, there was no provision, no rule allowing for CVP expansion, was there?
No.
No. That came through the hearing committee decision, didn't it? That expansion rule.
I guess I understand that. I'd have to check to be sure, I'm afraid, but yes. I think that's right.
Yes. I couldn't equally see any. Well, it would have been a Section 42 analysis.
Yes.
Section 42A analysis in the same way of this on the effects of that in terms of an assessment of allowing for that expansion in terms of the overarching impact on the health and wellbeing. It seemed to be driven by a view that vegetables are good and that therefore good for communities and therefore it's an affirmative of that aspect, that objective within the regional strategy seemed to be more of a focus.
Well, I mean, I understand that they heard a lot of evidence from the whole industry on the potential impacts on the ability to achieve the objectives. So that, in a sense, would have meant they were making a Section 32-type analysis behind their decision-making.
Well, did the council do a Section 42A analysis on that?
No.
And did the council revisit and do a Section 42 analysis that having allowed for the expansion of CVP, reconsideration of the Tangata Whenua ancestral land post the decision and view it took in the Section 32 report?
No.
One matter we touched on, because we saw it in the CSU recommendations, and you noted the reference in one of the policies to the potential for allocation mechanisms and the next plan change.
Yes.
And we've identified that those drivers were pretty clear in the CSG recommendations.
Yes.
Set behind there. Now, regardless of what the hearing committee did in terms of removing the date from the clause in the rule in terms of 2026, or suggesting that, well, we can't get too far ahead in this because these matters need to be grappled with in future plan change, not this plan change. What work has the regional council done to develop and explore options for those allocation methodologies that would potentially unlock the problem that has been faced by Tangata Whenua and Central Land since 2016?
I'm not aware of any specific work on that. I mean, we know that there is a lot of work being done at the Ministry for the Environment work in terms of risk tools. I don't know if that's any way into this or not, but no, we haven't done specific work.
In fact, if we go back as far as Variation 6, the river Iwi were seeking an allocation of water in that plan change, weren't they, originally?
I wasn't part of that process.
You're not aware of that?
No.
Right? But it's a long-standing issue, and it was clearly identified as a critical matter.
Yes.
Critical matter that had to be addressed in the next plan change, and the council needed to be committed to that.
Yes. But, I mean, this is the problem that I'm not aware, and I don't know anyone who is aware of any tool that would do that. That's kind of the problem. I mean, it's much bigger than just the Waikato Regional Council. This is science, and where does science go in terms of allocation? I'm not aware of anything that's getting close to that at the moment.
Yeah, look, I appreciate the comment, this is bigger than the Waikato, but fundamentally you've got an imperative here within the Waikato that's unique to the whanau.
Yes.
And these needs have been clearly identified.
Yes.
And the history is clear, and the impacts of Raupatu on having land, let alone being able to develop it. So, within that context, is your position that the Regional Council has really been waiting for national direction and the development of a national tool? Is that your sense?
My sense is it's not really something I think that the Regional Council can do, if you like, to go and try and create some kind of tool when it's, you know, nationally we are trying to do that. I don't know that we've got the kind of ability, resources to do that kind of, you know, primary research and development of tools. It's not normally the sort of thing that we would do.
So ability and resources, you mean whether you've got the capacity and the money to solve it? Yes.
I don't know if that's the only restriction. I mean, all I can say is, yes, I don't think work has been done. I won't know all the reasons why not. I haven't seen where it's considered whether it should be done or not. I'm only assuming that this is bigger than we are as an issue. It's something the whole country is grappling with.
Well, I wondered, perhaps it's a useful time just to segue slightly to the issue of data, I suppose, because in the accounting methodology or the accounting framework, because it seems to me that the accounting framework that's so essential for PC1 is not dissimilar to that kind of modelling that is required for allocation more generally, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to have allocation methodologies of some form in terms of whether it's discharges or takes for that matter, the critical issue is having the data, isn't it? Knowing what's going on within your catchment and your sub-catchment.
Yes.
Do you accept that?
Yes.
And so while we've got some strong methods in relation to an accounting framework, I suppose I have grave concerns sitting here listening to the fact that, as I think you might have said in answer to a question, that we don't have the science that aligns activities on farms with downstream water attributes and qualities.
That's my understanding, but I'm not a scientist. Mm. Yes.
Well, that's a fundamental problem to not only achieving the first 10-year state, but achieving Te Tiriti Whaimana at all, isn't it?
I agree it's a fundamental problem, but I don't have a solution to that problem.
And the Regional Council isn't developing one, that's what you'd say.
That's right.
And we've, I think you were present, Mr. Brockstock was giving evidence and he acknowledged the potential for intensity creep within even permitted activities where farms currently have stock at lower levels and they're increased up to the limits over the course and over the next 10 years. That kind of intensification can occur.
Yes, well, yes, I did hear Mr. Brockstock say that. I think we've tried very hard to put provisions in PC1 to prevent that kind of creep.
And the farm plans are going to be important in terms of some of that information?
Yes.
Depending on how regularly they're provided?
Yes. There's clear intention, at least for the permitted activity farm plans, to demonstrate that the risk of diffuse discharges is not increasing over time.
And obviously we've got the provisions for CVP expansion, which are an exception to the land use change. And again, you're satisfied that the mechanisms are in there to assess that and the implications of that in terms of... it's not neutral, is it, the impact of that expansion?
No, it's not neutral. Again, I think we've done the very best we can to recognise the need for expansion while making sure that it doesn't expand into those subcatchments where there is a high risk, particularly in terms of nitrogen. And I think there are some quite strong limits in 3.4a for that expansion. So it's kind of it is very limited ability to expand.
But you've probably done somewhat, we say best you've done the best you can in relation to those matters, and I'm just wondering really whether reflecting some of the questions that I've asked you and some of the considerations, whether you've done the best you can in terms of Tangata Whenua ancestral land, or whether it's just been easier to leave that in the non-compliant activity status.
I haven't had any proposal from the appellants of a rule, a discretionary rule or a restricted discretionary rule that has any kind of restriction on expansion, if you like. The rules that I've seen come through the proposals from the appellants have been general discretionary activity rules without any kind of restriction on how much conversion of land could occur through those rules. So there may be a way, and I've often wondered that myself, is there a way of having a parallel discretionary activity rule for Tangata Whenua land that limits things quite clearly down to in the same way that it has done for CVP. I haven't tried to write such a rule, and I don't think anybody else has that I'm aware of. I haven't seen any attempts that.
And I think Mr. Majuri took you to the rule proposed by Mr. Turner, I think, in that regard, and I think you know that there were a number of restrictions in that, but again, you're talking about restriction in the scale of what?
Yeah, in terms of sort of area or amount of contaminants used.
But you would have seen back to that Section 32 report that option for a discretionary activity rule had variations on it there that were proposed to either a cap on the amount of land or et cetera. So they've been on the table. It may not be the words of a rule.
I haven't seen any words to respond to.
Would that be a convenient time?
Yes, that would be a convenient time.
Very good.
Getting their service.